Hey guys, and welcome back to episode 148 of the Skullcast, the premier podcast about Berserk from the community at skullknight.net. I am your eternal host, Walter, and joining me today is only one person, and that is Azeel.
Yeah, it's me.
Yeah, we're giving the other two, Grail and Gubble Atula, some time off. If you have not seen their big news yet, they now have a little kid. They had a baby together.
A baby boy!
Yeah, congratulations to them. They're joining the world of parenthood. Happy to have some support. We could all use some support. All parents could. Holy crap. Spring break over here at my house, and it's going to be a week with the kids. So, yeah, that's about all that's going on. So, yeah, it's just going to be me and Azeel today as a result of that. We will have them back on, I'm sure, in the near future. But, hey, I remember what it was like trying to podcast with a newborn. You don't really get a dedicated 2 hours with no crying. It doesn't exist. Doesn't happen. So, yeah, that's totally expected that they took some time off. So, what are we here to talk about? There is no Berserk news. There's no news of the new episodes. There's no adaptation news. There's no video game news. There's no anything happening.
And well, is a new action figure being released by Fig Arts, I think it's a Shirky action figure. I've got some news.
Yeah, this is what it's come to. We don't have any actual news, so we go turn to the merch corner. Merch corner, there's a guy on a table over there at the end of the conference hall. Hey, what about me?
Well, I'm not going to comment on that, but at least, you know, there's a Shirky action figure being made, which doesn't look very good to me, by the way, but yeah. Mm.
Good Shirkei, you know, anything merch-wise?
Funny thing is the original Art of War one, very simple, very basic, and I think when it came out, it cost like $30. Mm. It's pretty good. I think for what it is, like it's just a piece of plastic, you know, but she's got her staff, she's got just standing there. It's you know, it gets the job done. Mm. I like it. It doesn't cost much, and the Prime one is, you know, giant. He's got shit all over the base as usual, very expensive. And there's one that was made for one of the festivals in Japan by a hobbyist. And I also, it's very like, it doesn't look like her at all. Mm. So, I mean, looks nice, but it doesn't look like the character. So I don't like it very much for that reason. So yeah, in that case, my favorite would probably be the original crappy and cheap Art of War one, which the quality to price ratio is pretty good on it.
Does it have a bloody edition?
No.
Too bad.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, yeah, it could have, you know.
Yeah, just add paint spray to her staff and all over her face. Would be very in keeping with Shirkei.
You know, they used to put like big drops of blood on God's sword, and so it's funny because at scale it doesn't make any fucking sense. You know what I mean? It's not like there's these giant, I don't know, blobs of blood, you know, hanging on a sword. But yeah, what can I say? A lot of people like this. You know, it's not. I mean, I never liked it very much, but when you see the amount of people who paid for it, smart business move.
Yeah, it's just that's one of those things where it's obviously hitting some demographic that I don't identify with or understand. So who am I to say anything about it? It's just not for me, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, at least you know you've got the regular edition, which all my gods or whatever Zod statues I bought from them were the regular edition without added blood on top.
Yeah, it's already not going to be palatable to when the family comes over and sees them. So why add blood to the mix?
Yeah, I remember once my niece, when she was very young, came over and she was like, seeing my Skull Knight bust with the giant spikes. She was like, huh, he didn't cut his nail. That was cute. I was like, yeah that's right, cool. Honey. She wasn't, funny thing is, I even didn't think about it. I was like, you didn't think it might be scary to a kid or anything, and it didn't faze her at all. All she thought about is he didn't get his nails cut.
I'm beyond such pleasantries is nail trimming.
Yes.
I figured she would say something like, oh, he forgot to take his Halloween decorations down, you know, because like Skull Knight just screams Halloween, particularly if his eyes are glowing, you know.
I could see how someone would be confused. You know, we don't have Halloween here in France, so.
What? Didn't we steal that from, like, we steal that from pagans?
You stole it from the Irish, yes, but yeah. I happen to live in another country.
Yeah, so. But Europe, quote-unquote Europe.
True. Well, we have something. I mean, we do have All Saints Day, which is a sad day where you go and put flowers on tombs and graves and so on. But
oh, yeah, that's like Halloween.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the not funky version of it.
I mean, it's just basically a candy holiday.
Yeah, I know. You forgot Slutty Nurse, this guy's holiday party for college. You know, I feel bad that I missed on that. You know, I really missed out big time on all the slutty version of costumes. I'm like, damn, to this day, I curse the heavens that I didn't live in the USA when I was in my, you know, I don't know, 20s or something.
I mean, I don't think I've only been to one adult Halloween party. I was in college. I wasn't even an adult. I mean, if you consider a college person an adult.
Just, drinking and, yeah.
Not too many slutty nurses in my experience. Mostly it's just little kids.
Oh, you're just breaking my heart over here.
The movies and TV shows are an exaggeration.
My dreams are shattered.
I do remember we went to Halloween my first or second year of high school, which is like age 14 or so, 15. Mm. And then you get the looks from the parents like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Go home. What are you doing? Stealing my candy, kid.
Yeah. It's funny. We do, you know, I mean, I've told you this before, but people have tried to bring Halloween to...
You told me about that. Yeah.
Times and times and times again. And sometimes you'll have usually a group of parents who are like, okay, we're going to do a Halloween for our kids. Mm-hmm. So those who are up for it, put some, I don't know, some yellow tape or whatever on your yard, fence and we'll come by and have candy prepared and so on. So I did it one time actually, I don't know, I'd say 5 years ago. There was 1 year some parents did it. So, I put some scary lights in my, in my garden. And because I've got, my driveway, if you will, is really dark at night. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of intimidating for a kid. You know, they wouldn't even go up there. So I was waiting there in the dark wearing some kind of hoodie or something. And I came in and like, here, take your candy. I was trying to give them some, you know, some little atmospheric.
But there were some kids that came out?
Yeah. I mean, they were with their parents and everything.
Yeah, of course.
It's not kids alone in the streets or anything like that. So, but yeah. I would say four or five groups came. Hmm. And it was very, like, they gave us a specific hour and so on. If it had been like, I wouldn't have stayed all night doing this shit all evening. So,
yeah.
But yeah, when I was a kid, we had Mardi Gras, you know, like, you have in Louisiana. But instead of women showing their tits, again, it's just about kids and candy and disguises. You know, all the fun stuff is, you know, taken away from us. You guys in the U.S., you get all the fun.
I mean, we have Mardi Gras too, but it's just, it's an excuse to drink tequila. And that's exclusively all it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I was saying because I remember.
Or am I thinking of 5th of May? I'm thinking of Cinco de Mayo.
Okay.
That's a different thing.
Yeah, because Mardi Gras is like, I mean, in the U.S., it's pretty much just exclusive to Louisiana, right?
Yeah, it is pretty much. Yeah, there are people that also do stuff here, but that's, come on, you're just... It's not real.
Yeah. And for us as kids, we had like a parade. Mm. We marched in the streets. We were all costumed. So parents had to do costumes for us. I think you've seen the one of me as a guy from Secret of Mana, right?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. That's
yeah, in my head, that was just Halloween. Obviously, now I know that
was
Halloween.
That was for Mardi Gras. So This one's in the vault. Not many people have seen it. Mm-hmm. But yeah. And so I believe. I can't remember, but I think we also got candy for that occasion. But
that's Halloween. That's just Halloween.
We didn't go door to door, so.
Okay.
We also have pack, you know, Easter. For that, you get candy in the, like. I mean, I'm even ashamed to explain that, you know, how it works, but you've basically got bells, magical bells.
I've heard of this. Who come David Sedaris. And, this is how I know this.
Yeah, and put, like, you know, fucking eggs in the garden. You have to go and get... I mean, it's very... As a kid, I love that shit. You know, you get chocolate. Yep. I'm not much for sugary treats. So, yeah. Anyway,
yeah,
why are we talking about this?
Well, we were talking about Skull Knight, who's obviously a Halloween, you know, themed...
True.
Looking thing to an outsider, they would assume
Halloween. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, if we it's true, if we had Halloween, I would put in by the window and I don't know. Yeah,
perfect. Well, I guess we'll move on to the the news was there's a Shirake action figure.
Yeah,
that's how we got here. All right, I'm not going to apologize. That's fun part of having a podcast,
sure,
going off on tangents, somewhat related. All right, we are here to start the next leg of the reread project, or starting volume 33. Because there's only two of us, we're only going to do four episodes today. So we will be doing, I don't actually have the episode numbers in front of us, but it's the first four in 33.
Yeah.
So follow along with us or just kind of listen to the summaries and you'll catch up with what we're going to cover today. First, as always, with the new volume, I like to talk about the volume as a whole. And the cover and all that kind of stuff. So let's start off with the cover. Makes sense. This is one of the more simple covers. Limited color palette. Griffith looking slightly off to the side. I wouldn't say over his shoulder because it's just looking off the side. Kind of has a cold, unfathomable look on his face.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically what's interesting to me about this is it is very subdued. It is it's a cold expression. It's white. It's basically white on white with a touch of blue in the hair. And it's like armor shadow has some blue to it. But it comes across to me as very refined. Like everything looks very elegant and simple. And like kind of a touch of class, I would say, to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very pure. Simple, almost like you mentioned, monochromatic. So it feels very, very much like Griffiths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's not much happening here, right? It's just a dramatic picture of Griffith. So yeah, kind of a bold cover choice because it's very simple. Moving on to the posters. The first is of Ganeshka transformed in Wyndham. I didn't actually like notice much of... first of all, your eyes are drawn to, obviously, the grotesque, monstrous look of Ganeshka now with the glowing red eyes, the multiple faces. In the foreground, we have these gargoyles, and at first, I felt it was kind of random that there's gargoyles there, and then you actually realized it's to emphasize the scale, right? The gargoyles are high up on a building, usually. They're everywhere, usually, but also, they are very high up, usually, right? So the idea here is he's huge, and in the foreground are these gargoyles, which are similarly quite tall, so it's emphasizing the scale, I think.
Yeah, it's meant to show him in the process of basically getting up. Mm-hmm. As he's destroying the town and becoming some kind of gigantic tower in the sky.
Yep. I think this is the only colored version of this, so it kind of gives you it kind of sets the table for what you can visualize with the black and white.
Yeah.
And yeah, the glowing red eyes. Also, the scene's at night as well, so limited colors on display anyway. Next poster is of Roderick. Both of these posters are very appropriately placed because these are two things that happen in this volume. Ganeshka is transformed and Roderick gets a big stage in this volume as he routs the pirates. So I feel like Mira is showing Roderick in his element here. You know, Roderick was introduced to us at a ball, which while he is a prince of Ys, he's more in his element here in the water, on the ocean, at the head of his ship. You know, he feels very calm, confident, in control. And here he is in his element, looking calm, confident, and in control. So, very dashing pose, too.
Yeah. He's a man of the hour, basically.
Mm-hmm. And I just noticed it here, but it's the very, what's the word? It's not watercolor, but the colors that Mira uses are not vibrant. They're very light. I wonder if it's colored pencil.
It's funny. He uses a specific term in Japanese, which is called light coloring, which you know, describes both watercolor and a colored pencil. And he actually uses a mix of both. So there is some watercolor here, but there's also colored pencils. So he mixes the two, and as he's done many times.
Yeah.
So a lot of his lighter colored pictures are, you know, kind of a mix of that. Sometimes he also inks them in some parts. It's his process is interesting. That's one of the things we saw at the exhibition. Mm-hmm. You get to see all those little details, and yeah, it's very interesting. And so, yeah, that one was definitely one of those types, whereas the Gadishka one was acrylic.
Right. Yeah, and you can actually see the difference in the canvas as well, because the Gadishka one, you can see through the texture of the canvas that it was painted on, which I always like seeing that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Moving on, we have the little, I call it the cover insert. It's not really, I don't know what to call it. It's just, it has the volume number over the face of a panel pulled from later in the volume of Griffith, looking very much like the cover, honestly. His head's just looking in a different direction. But the context here is different because he's obviously on the battlefield about to face off against Gadishka and his spawn. But yeah, looking very serious and also very otherworldly.
Yeah, I think Unfathomable, as you put it earlier, is really, really nails it, because that's ever since the incarnation, that's pretty much what he's been. He always looks pensive, almost far off in the distance, no matter what's going on. He's never showing any serious emotion. He's got it all figured out. Yeah, that's what his character is at that point in the series.
Before we get into the actual episodes, I just wanted to give a quick Volume 33 overview. So it makes sense that, you know, our characters have just been, I've just completed a long sequence of high action events over the past several volumes in Fraternis. The first half of 33 is relatively mild by comparison. It's a moment for them to breathe. So they're settling into life on their sea journey. They encounter pirates, but kind of quickly dispatch them. Guts rescues Casca from falling overboard. All of this leads to introspective sequences, one for Griffith, one for Farnese, one for Shirke. Overall, it feels like tone setting for their overall sea voyage. Like Mira's getting into it. Obviously, he started that in the end of 32, but this is where it really feels like thick with the sea battle. And Mira uses this downtime on the ship to give the characters some time to reflect about themselves and where they stand in a way that they didn't really have a chance to in Fraternis when it was action, 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 action. So he's, you know, maximizing that time, that downtime, by doing lots of inter-character dynamics. And of course, that's just the first half of 33. The back half of 33 is, of course, the start of the showdown with Gadishka and Griffith and Wyndham, which is one of the highlights of the whole series. You know, needs no introduction. You know what I'm talking about. We will get into that in the next podcast. We're not going to get into any Wyndham stuff on this reread. So, I added a little bit of info about 33. I've wanted to do this all along, but I always forget to do it. So, all 11 episodes were released between July 2007 and May 2008. So, a pretty quick clip for the whole volume to come out in just about a year. And it was a very quiet period for Berserk. Other than, of course, for the events of the manga themselves, there were no other adaptations or side projects circling around at this time. There were also, I could find, not many interviews or any that I found from Mira during this period. 2007 was the year that March Comes Like a Lion started production in, or publication, you know, Young Animal. And it's also when Koji Mori got married. I only mentioned those two because it's of the two, of the comments that Mira released with these episodes, it was two of the, you know, milestones that he noted in the Young Animal comments, along with this one. 2/3 of my body is made up of calorie mate, he says. I guess he's binging the calorie mate while working on Berserk. Something to keep in mind while looking at these detailed drawings. We're going to skip this little episode summary. I think you guys know what's been happening if you listen to the reread. So we'll just get right into it. Azeel, you have the first episode.
All right, so first one, 287, is called Futile. And it opens with Guts pensively watching Casca from afar on the seahorse. His vision suddenly blurs, which unsettles him. Meanwhile, Shirke and Farnese look at the scene in their bodies of light. Roderick comes around for a chat and asks him whether Casca is his woman, pretty straightforwardly. Guts starts answering, but we cut away from the scene as Farnese suddenly returns to her body, not wanting to hear it. Meanwhile, Cascar's followed a seagull and is climbing above the bar of the ship. Guts jumps down to try and bring her back, afraid she'd fall, but she won't come to him, not trusting him, and instead she tries to get farther away, and as the ship hits a wave, she loses balance and falls. Guts grabs her reflexively, but can't grip her arm with his artificial hand, so she plunges into the sea and he jumps in after her. He manages to bring her back into a rowboat Rodriguez sent for them, but exhausted by the ordeal, he lets himself plunge deeper as he recalls his past. He wakes up in bed aboard the ship, having been saved by Roderick, and as they're leaving to rest, he sinks back to his arm, a mere lump of iron attached to his body to crush his enemies, not something that could ever replace his actual arm. So as the episode ends, he reflects on how forcibly replacing the things he's lost can't make them go back to how they were. So this episode is very, very significant to me because Mira takes the time to pause and reflect on the past and the sacrifices Guts has made. You know, from a fan's general standpoint, Guts' artificial arm, it's an upgrade compared to his normal arm. He can brain someone with it. He can deflect blows with it. He's got a cannon in it inside, so it's one of his coolest and deadliest weapons. But from a real person's standpoint, you would never be better to have a fake arm than actually having all your limbs. So having grabbed Casca like he's done in the past, both in Volume 6 and 9, is a fantastic way to drive that point home. And beyond that, his comment can also be applied more generally to his relationship with Casca and the fact her restoration will not undo all of the traumas they've endured, not bring back their dead friends. So it wouldn't be like they came back to a good place. They still have to work from where they were. So overall, very, very nice episode and very, I would say, poetic and thoughtful and not something you often see in fiction. Beyond that, a few comments. So we see that Guts is in a bad way. He's burned all over. He's damaged by his use of the armor as well. We see that with his eyesight. Very important detail that gets brought back again and again and again to show us the toll the armor takes. It's a few panels, but makes a big difference here. We also see when he jumps down, he has to, adjust to the blow because his body is not well, and same thing when he sinks. We have a nice chat between Roderick and Guts, man-to-man talk. Refreshing to see Roderick ask a straightforward question about Casca, because that's not something, like, everybody's danced around it, including the ladies. So interesting to see the reaction it produces. And of course, Farnese can't bear to hear his answer because she already knows, of course, deep down, she knows what's going on, but she hasn't accepted it yet. So it's a step on her path towards acceptance. And of course, one of the things is when Guts is drowning, he reflects on how his memories of those days always end up the same with the eclipse. So it's a reminder of why he can't let it go and he's got that rage going and so on. So, those are my comments for it. I also have something to say about the title because the Dark Horse translated it as Bubbles of Futility, and literally in Japanese, the title is Suiho, and it just means bubbles or foam. But it refers to the expression Suiho Nikisu, which means it's used when something ends up being nothing in the end, like how foam will just disappear. You think you've got foam and then it just turns into nothing. So it's a very clever title in Japanese, but its full meaning cannot be translated to English. That's why we just went with futile for us, which is what it really refers to, the fact that futility is a fact. You think you have something, but it's nothing. And I think Dark Horse, they tried to have it both ways with Bubbles of Futility. But that doesn't really make sense unless you know the Japanese expression. So I think if they wanted to go that route, they should have probably gone all the way doing something like, you know, fleeting like a bubble or fleeting like foam, right, or whatever. Just to clarify that title thing, because literally it means bubbles, but the actual meaning it has in this context is something that is futile. So that's it for me. What do you think?
It's one of the, not often, there's a few moments where Miura really brings symbolism or metaphors to bear in a way. I'm thinking of the Bonfire of Dreams being a really, really stellar one.
Yeah.
To talk about the relationships of the characters and the Band of the Falcon in relation to Griffith and his dream, how they all work together to create a giant bonfire. This is another moment where it's just a very powerful metaphor to describe how a prosthetic, something forcibly replaced to so that he can carry on with his life, will never quite be the same, even though he thinks it is. And of course, all of it is it's tone setting for what's going to happen with Casca, because that's what they're here to do. They're here to restore Casca's mind. So I think it's like a little nudge from Mira that he recognizes, and readers should also recognize that Casca might come back, but it's not going to be exactly like it was. It can't be exactly like it was.
Mm.
So I feel like that's what this, even bringing this up now, that's the purpose of playing this card at this moment, is because we're on the precipice of getting Casca back. What will that mean? How will that play out? It will not play out in a way that is seamless or perfect. You know, it's not the old Casca 100% back. It's not how it's going to go. So I feel like it's a little nudge from Mira. I absolutely love this episode. I love when Mira takes the time to do these kinds of things. I like the high action moments of Berserk. Of course I do. I wouldn't be a big fan of Berserk if I didn't. But I mean, to me, it's about the characters and the characters recognizing strengths, weaknesses, all those kind of things. This is a moment for Guts to recognize, you know, face the truth about he and Casca and the prosthetic as well.
Yeah.
In a way. The prosthetic is just kind of like a vessel to deliver these things, I think.
It is, of course. But it's what's interesting about it is that it works on a literal level, mm-hmm. and of course also on a figurative and deeper one. So yeah, that's what makes it so interesting to me.
Yeah, and Farnese is really interesting in this episode as well, because she's basically been in denial. She does not want to face the truth, which is that she knows, and does not want to know. Because if it's for real that Guts and Casca are a couple, that limits her agency, you know, with her feelings for Guts, right? She can't act on them.
Yeah.
Not in confidence anyway. So yeah, she doesn't want to know. She'd rather live in denial than know. And Roderick basically forces the question. I do think it's neat. And I guess annoying as a reader a little bit, because I would love to know how Guts would phrase that, you know?
Yeah,
I don't know how he would end that sentence.
Same.
Like, what word would he use to describe his relationship with Casca, given that it's been all this time apart, you know? If he was describing her when they were still a fresh couple back in the Falcons, it might be one thing. But now that their relationship has changed so much, I mean, I would say, I can't say grown because it's one-sided, but yeah, how does Guts regard it? I'm curious. But we don't get to see that. He cuts it off. He treats it like the delivery of that line, it's almost like Farnese faints. I know that's not what happens, but she basically loses her focus and returns back to her body.
Yeah.
Her body of light goes back, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's as if she fainted in terms of what happens in the story, and she awakes.
Yeah,
realizing she didn't want to know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good analogy. It's like, it is like she faints, and mm-hmm. and I mean the effect is the same.
Yeah, we also see a little bit here. Shirke also is a little tensed up from what had happened, because she has a similar reaction, although it's not exactly the same as we'll get into in the next episode about Guts and Casca, which I thought was neat too.
Yeah.
What else did I like about this? I know it's really small, but Roderick kind of picking up on the vibe between Casca and him. It's as soon as Roderick arrives on the scene, you know, Guts is looking at Casca from a distance. And so Roderick asks, why don't you get closer to her? I mean, and then they have this little exchange of glances. And then he knows there's some subtext here. The subtext, of course, is that Casca is fearful of Guts, even though Guts loves her. So he's immediately picking up on part of the dilemma between Guts and Casca, you know, and just in a glance and just in one question, you know. I thought that was neat, kind of not explicitly getting into the problem, but gesturing at the problem.
Yeah, it's a wordless exchange. I mean, something Mira tended to do is that whole ability, like the characters don't need to always explain things to the reader. They can have an understanding of the scene and get to it without it being spelled out continuously. And that's very refreshing. And that allows things to move also at a faster clip. Mm-hmm. So, I also find it very neat that it goes on like this.
And I'm going about this episode backwards. I don't know why. It's just the way I'm thumbing through the pages. But I can't remember if we have seen a moment of Guts blindness happening before. Is this the first, or has it happened before? I don't remember.
Good question. I was wondering the same. I think this one is the first one.
I think so too.
Yeah, I think it's the first one where you start to get that, oh, I see. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a time when he's, you know, eating the bouillabaisse Serpico makes in the cabin on the beach, and he feels something's odd with the taste. And
right.
He just said, oh, it's just a small wound in my mouth. But we think back to what the Scunlight just said about him losing his senses.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we get this one. We get some more over time to the point where it's, yeah, it's clear what's happening.
Mm-hmm. I do hope it's conveyed to newer readers or first-time readers. I feel like this is probably lost on them because it's not paired with the beat you over the head Skull Knight panel of you will lose your senses, you know? It's left to the readers to do the math on what is happening with Guts' vision. I hope most readers can make that connection. I hope it's as effective.
Well, I mean, they should if they...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. If they care about the story. We didn't have a trouble. I mean, we made the connection immediately at the time,
mm-hmm.
right? So.
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it was lost on us, but I don't think everybody stops to pause to wonder about the possibility space for that.
I mean, that's a good point, but I mean, same for everything, right? If people mm-hmm. don't understand, I mean, there's a bunch of scenes even in this volume, which I think somebody could be confused about if they don't pay attention or...
Speaking of which, this is a perfect transition, actually, is in this scene, in all scenes where Guts is on the ship, he has his bandages wrapped around the prosthetic arm.
Yeah.
And I've actually, over the years on Reddit, I've seen this pointed out a number of different times. People look trying to get a quick laugh, like, ha-ha, they even bandaged his hand, his prosthetic hand. I can't get damaged. It's to protect it from the salt in the air.
Yeah.
Is there... near the ocean. And the ocean, when the ocean hits the wave, the waves hit the ship, it has a spray, right? And there's always some little bit of moisture floating through the air.
It would rust.
Salt water, which would rust.
Right? Yeah, because it's iron.
Yeah. Iron, salt, water, not great. Not great combo. So that's why it's wrapped up. Pretty good attention to detail from Mira.
Yeah. Same thing with, like, you know, later on they comment about the fact he's got a fever because he can't perspire well because of the burns.
Yeah, right. Detail. I'd never even heard of that kind of thing before. I'd never even thought about it. But yeah, it would cause him to have a fever because his body can't let go of the heat, basically.
Yeah. It's basically the air conditioner for the body's, you know, sweat. So, I mean, there's tons of stuff like that. Even if you look at the details on the ship, the what we call the cordage, you know, the where the ropes are all tied together, that kind of stuff.
I do like how when Guts plunges in to grab her, Guts is not a one-dimensional character. He's not just a big lug. He's not just a battler. He's not a monster. And so whenever we get into this scene, these memories, it's almost with like a tongue-in-cheek moment. He says, anytime she gets next to water, nothing good comes of it. He's remembering all these times where...
Yeah.
She's fallen into the water, right? And he's had to grab her. And it's almost like a comical thing. But it's obviously a serious moment, but I think it was really deft to insert a little bit of comedy there. Comedy is even the wrong word, but he's getting into it lightly. Like, this lady in water, basically, in a way that's also serious. So, that was very deftly done.
Yeah, I like the bubbles, the theme of bubbles of light, something we also see often when it comes to his memories.
Mm-hmm.
We also see that, for example, when Shurike dives into the armor to try and wake him up in volume 27.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Overall, very nice imagery. And I would agree that the way it's treated shows... I mean, it's always the case with Guts, but it shows he's the death he has mm-hmm. to his character, not just being a strong man or whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's all I had for this episode. Is a lot.
Yeah, one thing on the humor side is we get to see when he wakes up, he he thinks to himself, he's hoping Roderick didn't do mouth to mouth, and we get a little picture of Puck doing a big kissy face. Mm-hmm. But more funny than that is on the next page, we see Magnifico lying in bed looking like a fucking cadaver.
Mummy or something.
Basically, yeah. Because he's been seasick so long, barfing continuously, he hasn't been able to eat well, and mm-hmm. so he's got in this state. And yeah, that goes on for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I just found it pretty funny. It's just that kind of shape he's in. And everybody's like, oh, damn. He's not
worse
getting
than Guts.
Yeah, he's basically worse than Guts, even though he hasn't actually been doing anything.
He's been laying in bed barfing.
So, I don't know, pretty funny to me.
That's pretty good. I mean, he's a landlubber. What are you going to do? Rich kid, probably never even been on a boat outside of the shore.
Yeah, you are pretty much. So it's also funny because when you think back to his big speech at the ball, the big dreams, and we're going to conquer the world, blah, blah, blah. And then this guy, like, he's been, I don't know, they've been on the sea for maybe a week, and he's already in this state. So it's, it's just pretty funny.
Well, I'll take the next episode, which is Sea Battle Part 1. As Shirke etches the seal over Guts' brand, she realizes that she can feel sensations from him, the pain from etching the seal and the heat from his burned skin. She imagines it's because their ethereal bodies have been so close before, so she's attuned to these feelings. Guts' interrupted conversation with Roderick earlier about Casca also caught Shirke off guard. But while Farnese was in denial over Guts' feelings, Shirke accepts them, knowing that her connection with Guts is still special and unique. Meanwhile, Farnese is bathing Casca, and she gets some soap in her eye, so Casca, in return, splashes Farnese with a bucket of water, which sends Farnese into a bit of a rant about how oblivious Casca is to Guts, how he's been fighting for her over and over, risking his life, but she just doesn't understand and doesn't return the affections. Obviously, Farnese is feeling a little bit jealous of Guts' affections going to waste and that they aren't directed at her, and she feels that the whole scenario is unfair. On deck, Roderick and his first mate spot some incoming ships, three smaller sailing ships that initially start flying Ys's banners as soon as they came into view. Roderick saw through it immediately, of course, and calls his men to their battle stations, and the sudden movements catch the attention of everybody on board. As they get closer, they clearly see the pirate ship markings, and there's no longer a chance for subterfuge. It quickly becomes a battle between the Seahorse and the three pirate ships. In the first volley of cannon fire, it becomes immediately clear that the pirates are outgunned, and they can fire with accuracy. The pirates realize they aren't dealing with any amateurs, but a famous captain, the Sailing Prince of Ys. That's the episode. Tons of visuals here. I really love the introduction of the pirates, or the reintroduction of the pirates. Mm. Their ships all have little unique monikers, right? We have the Sea Louse, the Mud Snail, and in the middle we have the Captain Shark Rider, three names of the ships. And you can see on the prow they have little tiny little insignias representing them. Little details there. This is an opportunity to kind of get into a totally different kind of combat that Miura has never, ever touched before. Sea combat, right? So he's clearly read a little bit about the advantages and disadvantages of certain types of combat. I like that it goes right off the bat that the types of cannon, the type of artillery, not cannons that are used, make a difference. Like you want long range and you want accuracy in combat and sea. And then the next episode, he gets into totally different side of the tactics, which is, of course, maneuvering and wind and all that kind of stuff and upwind, downwind. It seems very, very thoughtful, all the details he put into it. That being said, this is pretty much the beginning and the end of Sea Battle. So he kind of put it all into one big, escapade, these two-part battle here.
Yeah.
Some of the things that happen with Farnese and Casca here and Shirke to me feel like a prelude to what happens to the Corridor of Dreams. Farnese coming to terms with her feelings of Casca and Guts, but until she's awake, Casca is a child, basically. The dynamic is not acceptable for Farnese that Guts has such devotion to this character. But I feel like as soon as Farnese realizes later on the truth, she stands aside and there's no fireworks to it. There's no furnace of envy that, threatens to engulf the group or anything like that. That's not what happens. But I feel like if you cut it off right here, it's actually very unclear what Farnese is going to do with this like anguish that she has here, you know, with this scenario between Casca and Guts. And ultimately she chooses to step aside with that much drama, you know, but leaving it here, it's a very open question, I think.
No.
Exactly what's going to happen with her.
I don't know.
No?
Well, I mean, so I think this scene lacks an important detail in the official translation, which is at the end, when Farnese talks about not being fair, she's referring to herself. Mm-hmm. What she means is that her prior rant wasn't fair to Casca, who is sick and doesn't deserve this sort of blame because she doesn't understand what's going on. So obviously that outburst came, like you said, both from her worry about Guts and more importantly, about the kind of jealousy she has towards Casca, which is the mm-hmm. only woman Guts loves. This is all kind of obvious to me. I just wanted to make it clear for the listeners. But what's important to me is that it's a step on a path towards acceptance that she can't be with him, which culminates in Skellig, when she first gives it up for good, you know, on the shore. Mm-hmm. She's at some point, she cannot just accept it. And then after the Corridor of Dreams, she decides to go further and help mend their relationship. Yeah. So to me, there's kind of a double thing going on, but if you just stop at this scene, I mean, obviously it's not resolved yet, but to me it's clear, like, we are on the path towards her accepting it. You know, again, previous episode, she can't bear to hear what she has to say, but I mean, obviously she knows how he feels. She's guessed it. She's not an idiot. She just doesn't want to admit it to herself. And this scene, she has this outburst, but she immediately feels shitty about it because she knows it's not Casca's fault. And that she doesn't deserve this kind of blame. So it's right. More like, why does he love you? Why doesn't he love me? Well, I mean, that's because that's what it is. And that's it. And I feel like even at this scene itself, you can already tell who is going to go. You can tell she's going to give it up and not, I don't know, not go into a knife fight with Casca to decide or try to steal a man. You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
I mean, it's hard for me to say. I never expected that kind of betrayal. But I did wonder exactly how it would be resolved, because to me, first of all, what happens between Farnese and Casca here, I can relate as a parent, because sometimes you're keeping your cool, and then but you have these feelings inside that don't come out. And then when you get splashed like that, you can kind of let loose a little bit, right? And so she kind of loses control for a moment and says how she feels. She's actually, how she feels is bubbling to the surface in a way that I've definitely experienced before.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, again, saying one thing I'll say is that same thing I've said many times before, so it's kind of just redundant at this point, but it's all realistic.
Yeah.
Like the way Mura does it, I don't know how he does it. It's so realistic. It feels real because it happens to real people. It's a small thing. You know, she's got these emotions that she's tried to keep to herself, and then a small thing and she just, the water breaks and she's going, why did you do? And then she's like, okay, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. You don't even understand what's going on. It's unfair what I'm saying to you. And the genius of the scene is that she starts by saying it's unfair that Guts loves Casca and not her. And then she ends up saying it's unfair that I'm blaming you while you're not at fault.
Right.
So, it reflects greatly on Farnese, I think, actually, that it goes that way. That she's able to see immediately that she's just being shitty and that, well, I mean, she lets go of her emotions because, she's in love with a man who doesn't love her back. And unfortunately, that's not going to change.
I do like that Casca tries to understand what's happening and she doesn't. And so she thinks, you're mad at me because I splashed you.
Yeah.
And so she picks up the bucket and splashes, dunks herself, you know.
Yeah, that's so cute. That's so great. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's such a great scene, man. It's everything about it is great. Yeah, the fact Casca splashes herself because she thinks that's what Farnese is mad. I mean, it's so, you know, it reminds me almost of a dog or something who knows he did something bad. He doesn't know exactly why, so he's just looking at you. It's like, oh, it's like that. Or, I mean, I guess a very young child. So it's such a great, I don't know, great scene in every way. And one of those things that are maybe overlooked too much compared to how really well-crafted they are, basically.
And also, I didn't point it out, but there's a little like cameo here that Serpico came to deliver some fresh clothes for their after-bath, you know, scene. But obviously stuck around to listen in.
Yeah, he's snooping in, yeah. Mm-hmm. Dirty little fucker.
I mean, it's one of those things that it doesn't go anywhere. It just, to me, it just shows that Serpico is observant and is trying to, in his way, look after Farnese, who herself is growing independently and doesn't really need him anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, Serpico's got not a great role here because he's still trying to care for her, but while staying out of the picture. So he's really, like, the whole time on the ship, he's very in the background, basically.
Yeah.
Caring, but trying to let her go at the same time. And he, again, that's a very, how to say, realistic thing, very manly thing to do, you know, to pine after somebody and try to do good at the same time, staying out of the picture because you want her to go or something like that. I don't know. That feels very much like his character. You know what I mean? It's kind of a self-sacrifice in a way.
It is. He's definitely not putting what he wants first. He's putting what she wants first, right?
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing that I feel like, and this is going to sound like really chauvinistic, but I apologize in advance. Like it feels like the kind of like value that women say they want, but never actually want.
Oh, yeah, true.
Just a little bit.
The
judo syndrome, basically. Yeah. Oh, judo's great. I'd date judo.
I want
you'd never date judo.
I want a nice guy. No.
Yeah,
every woman wants a charismatic dude and not the loser guy who hangs with him. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's very so nice and kind, but doesn't have the big car or the.
Yeah. He doesn't. Yeah. Yeah. Serpico doesn't have the Pontiac, you know. He needs to have the Firebird to get my love.
Yeah. Like Biden, you know.
Exactly. Just thinking about Biden. Yeah. The Onion's version of Joe Biden.
With I'd vote for that, glasses. Joe. If you had glasses and the ice cream.
I'm gonna shut up about this episode in just a second, but I wanted to point out I caught this in the reread. I love this single page transition that we go from the battle station scene. So on the top half of this one single page, we have the men getting the cannons out the ports. Is port the right word? No, the little windows basically. There's a word for them.
I think ports might be correct for it. Honestly.
Anyway, we see them loading up, and then the bottom half of this page, you see the sound of all this commotion has caught up to the main characters, and we see them all reacting to it. I thought that was very cool because it's like a very in the moment, like what's the word, environmental stage setting or scene setting for what's actually happening, how they're reacting. You see this really cool Shirke mixing up powders and I'm assuming like a pulse disc kind of thing for guts probably. You see her like with all the herbs that are laid out, like a little garlic, you know, little turnips or something. Yeah, she's very detailed.
She's even heating stuff up like almost in a Bunsen burner, you know. So, and you've got Isidro and Puck fishing on the.
Oh, Puck with a little fisherman's hat thing.
Yeah, it's very
tiny little details.
Yeah, it's funny because I also wrote that page down as being so great. Mm-hmm. The way it's very cinematic.
No words. Zero words.
Yeah.
Oh, what's happening? What's that sound? Men, load the cannons. None of that shit. Just, you can get it.
Yeah. You know, just get flow. It. One page, all these little panels, you get what's going on. Like you said, great transition. Very well done. Love it.
How would this be done in the Berserk continuation?
It would take, I don't know, 11 pages.
10 pages.
11 pages. And you'd still not understand, like you still would convey less information and people would be confused about what's going on. What? Is Shirke preparing something for the battle?
Yeah.
It would be like that.
Anyway, couldn't resist getting a little hit in there. We didn't talk about the pirates at all because we've already talked about them before, right?
Well, I mean, I got some notes, but...
Okay, go for it.
No, nothing much. I just said I wrote love, love, love the pirates. The boss and his first mate are just amazing. Very funny, banter between them. I also noted that, Dacos keeps, piratifying the dialogue.
Yep. They can't resist it. Just like I couldn't resist kicking the continuation in the ribs. They can't resist, say, slotting in some arbitrary pirate speak.
Yeah, gotta be me hearties and this kind of stuff. The original is much more straightforward. He calls these guys Yarodomo, which basically means, I don't know, you bastards, whatever. It's exactly the kind of way, a gang boss, a bandit boss would refer to his men. So, but yeah, I mean, generally just loves that dialogue. The fact the first mate says something, the boss tells him stupid, then he says they're going to do the exact same thing he said after kicking the other guy. The fact the first mate is crying because he got smacked in the head.
Well, he got smacked in the head for delivering a good plan, and then the boss is like, that's a good, I'm going to take that plan.
Yeah. And he's got that little tear in his eye. I don't know, it's just great. Just love that stuff. Honestly, I love these guys.
Well, they're only here. They're trying to not be pirates.
Yeah,
the whole
true.
Scenario here is like we're turning a new leaf. We're going to sell legitimate cargo.
We're
going to
be slavers. Yeah, and it's so the thing is great is when they're slavers and the guys call him boss and he smacks him in the face and tells him to call him captain because now he's a respectable man.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
He's a respectable man, but each time they call him captain, he smacks him in the face, telling them to call him boss because again, it's like saying a bandit or gang leader, you know, it's not. So yeah, it's just, I don't know, just great stuff. I love those scenes. I love his face. I love, you know, there's a lot of also reference to sharks and because their ship is a Captain Shark Rider. And so he's, how to say, there's a whole thing about stubbornness of sharks that comes into play again and again, even when they're transformed. So yeah, generally just love these guys.
Yep. Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. Just I like that they are so simple and... colorful, right? Yeah. I like that it's not just, it's also, you get these little asides where the boss is talking, sorry, the captain or boss is talking, and his men always have some kind of side comment to make about what he's saying. Usually there's some kind of side comment.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch for as well.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned earlier that about the cannons.
Yeah.
And I had also taken note of that because that played a real role in history too. You know, the British, they had a system of cannons they implemented earlier than the French, for example, which gave them an advantage at some time and so on and so forth. So cannons really played a big role in naval history, which would seem obvious, but I love the fact Mira kept note of that and implemented it, state-of-the-art ship like the Seahorse would be better equipped than whatever garbage these guys are running. Mm-hmm. And also at the beginning, we see Shuriken's crush on Guts. We see that it's still there. And she deals with it in a surprisingly mature way, I think. She takes comfort in the fact, because it seems to me she stayed around to hear Guts' answer. And it's kind of a cock-blocking move from Mira that he doesn't show us what it was. I noted it at the time, and I still feel it now. But I like that she's obviously still kind of got that puppy love thing going. But she takes comfort in sharing something unique with him, even though she can't be his lover, even just because they've got, 10 years age gap or something. But, yeah, she's got something she shares with him. As far as that whole dynamic with Yamo, and to her, that's a small, comfort, even though she knows she can't be in a romantic relationship with him. And I just thought that fitted her character well, because she's that kind of a smart girl. And yeah, just liked how it's done. And you would think it would be tough to have both Farnese's feelings and Shiruke's little crush be addressed together, side by side, or in a row, and yet, you know, the two are done very tastefully in a way that feels again real for how a girl like her might feel. So, yeah, I don't know. I just thought that was very, very well done.
Yeah, it's like Shirke's relationship with Guts is not threatened because her unique connection to him is that thing that they will always need. It's also like he needs like a study partner, and he's like the dumb jock, and she's the smart brainiac and the nerd, right? And he needs help with his homework. So they're always going to have the homework help.
She's got the PDA with which she can hack the whatever locker room at the gym or something.
That's right. Scooby-Doo-ifying Berserk.
Yeah. Your plan better work, Nerdlinger. That's something from the Simpsons, I think.
Nerdlinger.
Yeah. Something where they got a Brabham going to go against the... Oh, my God. I can't remember. You know, I can't believe I remember this kind of stuff.
Yep.
Anyway, it's just because the name Nerdlinger makes me laugh. It's such a stupid... Anyway.
I'll pass it over to you for the next part of Sea Battle.
Yeah. So we get Sea Battle 2, episode 289. So the Seahorse absolutely wrecks the pirates, with two ships out of three being out of commission before they even get in range to fire. The boss tries to get his own ship, the Captain Shatrider, close enough to board the Seahorse, but he can't maneuver between those two other broken ships, and the smoke impedes his vision. Meanwhile, Roderick has positioned the Seahorse against the wind, which the pirates perceive as stupid, but is actually advantageous in this situation not only because it's blinded them with the smoke, but it also avoids exposing the deck to cannon fire. So when the Captain Shatrider fires, it hits below decks and basically spares the Seahorse most of the damage. The Seahorse is also particularly nimble, and Roderick manages to move it to the other side of the Captain Shatrider while it's blinded, meaning by the time the smoke clears, the pirates are completely blindsided, they get hit with a huge broadside, and they retreat pathetically. Now, as Roderick tells the crew to relax and asks Isidro to go inform Farnese that things are fine, we cut to them in the hold with Guts having a feverish nightmare. The episode ends with pages of the Beast of Darkness covered in chains. I know this kind of goes with every episode, but absolutely gorgeous illustrations of the sea battle here. Really, really nice stuff. Love. It's a feast for the eyes. I love at the beginning when Puck is between Isidro and the spyglass. Really funny moment. You know, there's a pun with sumo that Darkos struggled to translate with Puck. Honestly, it's understandable because Isidro basically misunderstands a word Roderick is using for a word in sumo fighting. So it's the kind of stuff that, you know, literally makes no sense if you're not Japanese. So impossible to translate. I also love that Isidro recognizes that Roderick's actually a badass in his own field and not just a ladies' man. And his enthusiasm for the battle is so refreshing to me. I don't know. It felt refreshing because you could be jaded seeing this. Oh, it's not like Guts is fighting, whatever, but it's actually so cool. And the tactics are great. I mean, I love tactics, right? So, I don't know. I shared in Isidro's enjoyment, and I really just like how it's portrayed.
It also works because Roderick is very subdued.
Yeah, here. Exactly.
So Isidro is the one to be loud about the victory.
True. Very good observation. Roderick is a serious, stern captain doing his job, and so Isidro is enthusiastic for us. That's a great comparison between the two. And that's about all I have to say.
Yeah, I actually no notes. That's what the kids say these days when everything worked out really perfectly. I don't have anything written. It's the sea battle. It is the climax of the sea battle. If I had to have any highlights, it's the 2-page spread early on in the episode where we see the pirates getting blasted from the rear. Looks like. It's the front. Just getting wrecked.
Yeah.
You can see in the background the Seahorse. I like that we have the volley of the cannons. The way it's portrayed is very cool. And also,
yeah,
it's probably the most detailed ship art that we have in this whole section. It's beautiful. All the masts, all those goddamn ropes on the masts. Holy crap,
man. Yeah. Even the waves are very detailed, you know?
It's incredible. Any quadrant of this 2-page spread is just, you know, full of detail. It's crazy.
Yeah. And we even see how the, I forgot if it's the Silas or the other one, actually gets blown up. We see like fire coming near the cannon powder, then that exploding on top of the rest. And it, again, another example of half a page. It's just half a page of details.
Yeah.
But you get so much information about what's going on. You know, like everything is clear. So really masterful stuff.
Mm-hmm. As they withdraw, the captain just says, those who fall behind, get left behind. See ya. And just leaving his people to die basically on the ocean.
Yeah. What a piece of shit.
What a leader.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he got fucked. And he, of course, he blames his first mate, when they lose. Mm-hmm. So it's so, you know, it's so great. He blames him when he goes for it. He blames him when, you know, he thinks he's going to win. He blames him when he loses.
I think it's the first mate that says we shouldn't have picked a fight. And then the captain saying, oh, shut up.
Well, yeah, you're right. You're right. He's the one
who says I was confused too.
Yeah, yeah. Even though, so I think because he's the one who first went after them, right? Yep. And the boss yells at him. So he's also a guy who likes to take credit and then blame others regardless of his own implications or what he believed before.
Yeah,
I guess just one other thing to say is that when we see the chains, they are plunged directly into the beast's flesh.
Yeah,
and that's pretty hardcore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a new little wrinkle in the beast's whole thing.
Yeah,
these little barbs sticking out of the chains.
Yeah.
One last thing I wanted to point out was, and I kind of alluded to it earlier, is that, you know, because Roderick is so level-headed and reserved in the victory, so Isidro is the one that, you know, shouts about how great the victory was.
Yeah.
Earlier, though, because Isidro was left on deck, like he was allowed to hang out and watch the battle, Roderick then is able to explain things to him in a way that, you know, that's just a good thing for the reader to have somebody to explain things to.
Yeah.
Isidro is the vessel for us to be told why he's maneuvering the way he is. It allows them a better angle to shoot from, and the smoke blinds the enemy, et cetera, et cetera. So all these things that are, you know, require explanation so that they go seamlessly. Isidro is there to catch all that.
Yeah. It's an excuse, a storytelling device to tell things to the reader. Yeah.
Yep.
By the way, did you notice when we see, the cargo hold, Casca is grabbing a rat by the tail.
I did not. I was thumbing to the page to see that. Yeah. Is that what? It's too small on my, because I'm looking at the Kindle edition.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, cool. It's she's basically caught a rat. It shows, you know, funny thing is there's a lot of things is what I will say. If you actually read Berserk and pay attention to the Casca panels, she does a lot of things. She's always doing something, usually something goofy. And it's funny because it shows, like, despite her condition, she still got the reflexes. You know what I mean?
Is that Magnifico next to her? He's raising his arms like he's getting stepped on, I'm assuming.
He's I don't know. He kind of looks like, he reminds me of the Chinese zombies.
Yeah. Arms out.
he's like a dead man, truly.
He does look like a corpse.
Yeah, he's really in a bad way.
All right, we'll get into it. This is an all-timer episode, Roar from the Darkness. In Gut's nightmare, the Beast of Darkness speaks. It's struggling against chains which stick out from it in barbs. When the Beast speaks to Guts, the words I and you are one and the same. It tells Guts that, and I tried to summarize all this, but it's all pretty important, so I'm going to take a rare move in the spirit of clarity. I'm just going to read all of Puella's translation from this section.
All right.
And I'm not going to use the Beast's voice. I'm not going to read it as the Beast would do it.
Do the Beast's voice. The Beast's voice. The Beast's voice.
My throat couldn't take
it. We all want a Beast's voice.
God, it would ruin this whole reading. It would ruin the whole podcast. Okay. Don't think you can tie me with that yoke. At the moment you got that husk, he means the Berserk's armor, I was already unleashed. That impudent little witch thinks as if she has tamed me, but it was just one moment. Your new companions, the ones who you should protect. A warm light. Maybe it isn't bad that you depend on such a thin chain for now. But since they are with you, the more they are related to me, the more these idiots get to expose themselves to the jaws of death. And they will be crushed, torn, and ripped apart soon. Just like that time. Which he means the eclipse. Cherish them, only to lose more. And when that happens, no one will be able to stop me/you. I will swallow you entirely. I will rush with hatred and rapture to chew and grind the true light that burns you with my fangs. For now, it's okay. I'll follow you. I'll gather my breath at the bottom of my deep darkness. I'll save my power as much as I'm tied and suppressed. And then, in the end. When the nightmare's over, Guts can't recollect what happened. And Isidro then brings news of their victory against the pirates, and everyone goes up to celebrate. Meanwhile, Magnifico lays out his plan to Roderick to conquer Skellig. He wants to capture and sell the elves back on the continent. and then maybe breed them and create a huge market for elves. Puck overhears, or at least is in the scene, and instead of exposing the evil plan, agrees to help them as long as he can become king. As Roderick departs, he notices Farnese has climbed up. She relates to them how flying over the ocean made her feel powerful, but she knows that she's not of any real use. Roderick points out that the group wouldn't work if there were someone that was completely useless, and that bearing the responsibility for Casca is what allows the group to fight so seamlessly, and Guts trusts her with that important task. Farnese accepts this, and they seem happy together. Meanwhile, everyone has fallen asleep, and Guts stands watch, looking out at the sea and the moon. That's the episode. This is one that I have particularly turned to a couple of times, trying to decipher what exactly the Berserk continuation folks took from this scene, and how it should or could be haven't been interpreted to what's happening now in the action. Because it does, I do think it is suddenly relevant again. But to me, I feel like this whole stroke of having the beast take a moment, I feel like it's a reminder for all the sequence of events that were and that are about to happen, that this like conflict in Guts has not gone away. It is still hungry. It is still ravenous. It has not been resolved. So this like dangerous power in Guts, even though it has temporarily been restrained by this symbolic chains, which represent, you know, his relationships with his friends, they will not hold it back ultimately. And that there is still a reckoning to come with the beast.
Yeah, I would say it's more than, so I agree with what you said, but I would say it's more than just a reminder, precisely because we see those chains. And to me, it's at the beginning of Guts trying to tame the beast, hold it back, or do something. And it's related to the armor. It's basically when he's using the armor fully to its full power, he loses control of himself and he'll just kill everybody, you know, anybody that's in front of him, including his friends. And so, yeah, those chains, however thin they are, like the beast says, are a way to try and rein it in, keep it back, hold it in so that even as he's using the armor, he won't go completely mad and kill them. And yeah, and the beast tells him, well, I mean, as soon as you got it, it was already too late and it's not going to work. And so that's what we see. That's how it pans out, once they're on the solitary island where, when he activates the armor, we see the chain start to break, and then he's interrupted before something bad can happen. But yeah, the danger is it was going to happen. Like the chains were not strong enough. And so I feel like on the island, on Skellig, facing off against Griffiths, we are most certainly planned to have that come into play again, because we see the armor again just before with Guts and Hanar warns Guts again about the armor and he dismisses them. So it was going to come into play again and he would have had a near-death experience with one of his friends probably or something like that. But something serious would have happened which would have made him realize he needed to do something. He couldn't just keep going with the armor. It's just too dangerous. And either try to really tame the beast up for good or try to do things differently with the armor. In any case, do things differently so that he gets a different result. So yeah, very important moment to develop the story. And of course, again, like you said, reminder that what the beast is, why it's there, what it wants, and why Guts companions are a hindrance in the past to revenge and revenge and revenge and revenge.
It's also, it's striking at one of Guts' greatest fears. You know, one of the lines that the beast says is basically, yeah, you've developed some friends. How nice. You'll lose them again just like before. So as far as you think you've come, don't worry. Well, I'll make sure you fall and that you'll fall even harder the closer you are to these people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, of course, got to be one of Guts' greatest fears is having, you know, to develop friends and then to lose them again.
Yeah. And it goes deep into his whole trauma. And that's a very interesting thing, which is, I think, not often explored, is that when we are introduced to Guts in the Black Swordsman arc, he's pushing people away. He's very caustic and cynical and really even mean to people. But at the same time, he's very, like, you can tell he's hurt. He's very upset when Vargas gets killed. He's hurt when Teresia basically yells at him. He even cries.
Colette, too.
Yeah, Uncle at 2, yeah, sure. When she actually gets killed and attacks him, he's really, he even freezes on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell he feels these things and he doesn't actually believe what he says. He's not an asshole. He's just someone who's been traumatized. And so the reason he has waited so long to make new friends is because, yeah, he's still very deeply traumatized by what happened at the eclipse. And he thinks back to it often, even when he plunged into water with Casca. So getting these people again, opening himself up to them, yeah, there's a risk he'll lose them again. And that's one of his biggest fears. But at the same time, the beast, which represents, I mean, in Freudian psychology, you would call it his pulsion of death.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it rejoices in the idea that he might be hurt again, miserable again, and just might fan up his hatred and rage. But all of this is just really like it goes in the wrong direction. It's basically a path to self-destruction, to losing himself. If you want to tie it to the armor, it's like if Flora's talisman was destroyed, his ego itself would be dissolved and he would just become some kind of raving madman, and just die one way or another miserably. So it's what he has to avoid, and yet it's represented in this part of him that just desire, yearns for revenge, yearns for that, for only that. So it's an interesting, internal conflict.
The introduction of the chains in this episode also, I think it's a very, like, it's again, just like the arm, the prosthetic arm earlier, it's a figurative and a literal metaphor, because obviously, like, a rabid beast is chained somewhere so it can't get loose and can't run around and be wild, right? That works for a wild animal.
Yeah.
And here it works, obviously, as a metaphor for his connections, literal connections to his friends that prevent him from running wild, right?
Yeah.
So it's a very, very, very thoughtfully done. I do think that, you know, first of all, we do see the chains again before we get to the island. We see whenever they're on the solitary island. Sorry, I said island, I meant Skellig. On the solitary island, there's a threat when the beast is in proximity to Casca. We see the chains start to crack or break. It's in there. The chains are in its mouth. It's ready to break them. Which would basically mean that he would have no problem slicing right through Casca and his friends. It doesn't happen. You know, the boy rescues him from that moment. We don't get to that point. I note that to say the actual breaking of the chains would be a final moment for Guts, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't think you can come back from that. I don't think you break the chains and go wild, kill your friends, and then come back to being Guts that we know. I don't think they could pull that off. You know what I mean? So my point is, when they show the chains breaking in a way that's not supposed to be prophetic, like we're seeing it here in this nightmare, they show that in the continuation, and I feel like it's kind of a betrayal of the purpose and meaning of those chains. If we see the chains broken on the ground, that should signify that Guts has given up on protecting his friends.
Yeah, I think it's more than that. Even it's more like a, while using the armor, you know, he's even his self has dissolved, or at least been overtaken in a way that is that is kind of a point of no return. So, mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, the chains represent his bonds with his friends, holding back that dark flame of revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And while using the armor, of course, because that's a situation in which it might overtake him. When he's just himself, you know, there's no risk. And so if it breaks, that means the armor is in full control and then he might do something terrible. And of course, once he does that, I mean, there's no, like, even if he woke up, what would he, you know, to do what? You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Exactly.
If he woke up and he had killed Casca, he would just jump from a balcony or something or fall on his sword. So this kind of stuff makes no sense thematically to explore. It's a point that will not come because the story can't continue if it does.
Well, that's enough about the beast. I do love this sequence. It's lovely in how nightmarish it is. There's a lot of textures and screen tones that are used to achieve that nightmare effect throughout the whole scene. I love it, particularly the last page. You can almost hear the chains being dragged the way it does it. Very, Very cool paneling. Moving on, we actually have this go from this really dark moment to this very celebratory moment. You know, Guts tells Isidro, who comes down screaming into everyone's ears, that they've won. They've won. Guts says, let's head up. It's dark down here. So, you know, nice thematic way to transition the scene to the lightness up there.
Yeah.
Everyone's drinking. Even Isidro appears to be drunk in this scene. Azan's little feathers that come off of his helmet are kind of bent and messed up, as if it's implying that he's drunk too through the feathers. Is this the birth of his alcoholism?
He's had two drinks in the entire series, one here and one drinks the feast at Elfhelm. In Boss case, everybody's drinking. I mean, including Isidro, who's actually drunk, you know.
Yep. Citro's definitely tossed.
Azan looks fine here. But yeah, I love that whole scene. Even Puck and Ivarla dancing. Mm-hmm. Serpico being like uneasily, you know, getting his glass refilled, his cup refilled continuously. Great, great stuff.
And Puck at the very bottom has like a salaryman tie around his head kind of thing. He's at the office or after the hours kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. He's got definitely the salaryman, the drunk salaryman look on him.
Mm-hmm. Hides in a barrel while Isidro, fucking A, Magnifico lays out his master plan. I like that Mira spends like 2.5 pages with this plan that never goes anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just like Magnifico's, you can see how into it, how much he's thought about this. My master plan, his heist that is doomed to fail from the get-go. This is his direction for now. He has to seize an opportunity. This is the opportunity he wants to seize. He wants to exploit elves.
Enslave elves. I mean,
elf slaves.
Yeah. It's really enslave and sell them off. What's funny about it to me is because of his weight loss, because he's been barfing the whole trip, presumably, he looks especially sinister. So he explains that plan looking like, I don't know, some kind of evil guy, but Roderick is just dumbfounded because he's so stupid.
Yep. Roderick the whole time is like, right? Yeah. What are we doing? What are you trying to do? Are you sure this is going to work?
And then points him to the barrel where Puck is eating apples.
So sure, yeah. It bears explanation because it's a particular adaptation of Treasure Island. This is supposed to be Jim Hawkins. Like, it's the portrayal of Jim Hawkins, the character of Treasure Island.
Yeah.
Puck is wearing the distinctive look on his face of Jim Hawkins in that adaptation of Treasure Island.
Yeah, by Osamu Dezaki. It's a very famous, he was on TV when I was young. Mm-hmm. So, and it's funny because when he's got the salaryman look, he's got these, glasses and fake nose thing. And so he's taking it off. And so you can see it's Jim Hawkins. Mm-hmm. So funny to me. It's really a great scene. For people who knew that series, it's such a great reference. It's just crazy, actually.
Also, it is a rare thing where often when he does these little chibi impressions, they're usually small in a corner. You're going to have to zoom in on it to really see what it is. Here, he gives it a full panel, a real zoom in on the thing. So there's no mistaking the resemblance. And there's even a little note, which is also fairly rare. I can think of like two other instances where Mira did this, where he like explicitly noted what the reference is. You know, my apologies to Mr. Dezaki-san probably.
Yeah, well, I mean, honestly, you don't need the... Like, it's really a spitting image of, I don't know if you ever check what the anime was like, you'll see it's really like unmistakable, but I think he really wrote it. He had to write the copyright thing and he wrote the apology note just as a way to say he's sorry to just making fun of that iconic character, basically, or iconic portrayal at least.
Yeah. Yeah. And then a Puck reveals that, not reveals, Puck, we get to see Puck as Elf King. He's imagining what it would be like. And
yeah. So
he has this very curly beard and everything. He still has his bloody needle as his scepter.
Yeah.
Pretty good stuff.
Yeah, telling him to that his head is high. Mm-hmm. Zugata Kai, which means, literally it means your head is high. It's what the emperor would say in Japan, or the shogun, whatever, to tell a guy to... Basically, he's being arrogant. Mm-hmm. And usually to lower his head, you just cut it off. Not so high anymore now. So yeah, pretty great scene. By the way, there's a scene also at the beginning, something I feel many people might overlook. When Guts wakes up for the nightmare, he sits up suddenly, and because Ivara was lying on his chest, she's thrown off. And actually, he does exactly the same thing when he wakes up after jumping in the water. Exactly the same scene. And so Yeah, she's pissed at him because he keeps doing that. You know what I mean? So.
Oh, wow. That's, I got to go back and look at that now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. And, you know, I mean, when he wakes up from the nightmare.
Oh, I see her little legs from the very beginning. Wow, yeah. That's funny.
Yeah. It's literally the exact same way. So, yeah.
That's something, man, like less than 1% people are going to catch. Those two little legs off in the panel. And then the repetition of that same gag. Wow. That's good eyes, Azeel.
Yeah, no problem.
We end this episode basically with this scene between Roderick and Farnese. And I feel like it's a way to tie these two closer just a little bit.
Yep.
But it's also a way for Farnese to more explicitly detail what's going on in her head.
Yeah.
You know, she's made progress with magic, but she still feels like she has not found her groove yet. But Casca is her groove. I mean, magic also is her groove, right? Casca and magic are her groove. She's just not accepting of her validity in the group.
Yep. And I mean, so it's very interesting, that scene, because it directly follows the rest. She both unloads what's on her mind to Roderick. And also it's to me, it's a way to say, well, might not work out with Guts, but this guy's waiting for her. You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yep.
So it's also a way to show it's a path again. It's a step on a path towards something more with Roderick in the distant future. But yeah, very interesting in that context that she would confide to him and also, I don't know, be comforted basically with the whole thing with he gives her his coat and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to me, definitely shows what path they're on towards something. Yep,
agreed.
Maybe.
The coat on her looks pretty cute too.
Yeah, definitely. So she, you know, I definitely get the feeling she'd warm up to him once she had made peace with Guts and Casca and so on.
Yeah, I really just feel like they needed more opportunities like this.
Yeah.
For them to really explore that, but we don't get many of these kind of scenes. I feel like there would have been more.
Yeah.
I do think there would have been more. It's just we don't get to see them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we didn't get there because Mira passed away. But I think that was in the cards for the future, definitely.
Yeah, and likewise, Serpico here is snooping as well.
Yep.
In the background, you can see Puck still directing Magnifico around.
Yeah, that's another great detail. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that stuff. Mm-hmm. I love that stuff, and I love that when it actually comes to fruition, Puck has even forgotten about it.
Yep.
Magnifico has to remind him. He's like, oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll do it. Then he mm-hmm. then he does. So great.
And we end with this kind of enigmatic scene of Guts just looking out, kind of unclear exactly what's going through his head, but there he is.
Yeah, pensive. And, you know, it's exactly how the volume begins, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, sure. He's looking pensive at Casca, just seeming lost in thought.
Yeah. And that's the end of that section of Volume 33. We don't really return to the group until 35. We have a little bit, a tiny little glimpse of it
yeah.
in the midst of the Ganeshka and Griffith showdown.
Yeah.
But we're kind of stepping away from this group for a while.
Yeah, for 17 episodes.
Yeah, long stint.
Yeah, which is worth funny because, you know, at the time it was when people were all going on about online, about the whole, when are they going to get off the boat? When are they going to get off the boat? And meanwhile, we were having this kind of insane confrontation between Ganeshka and Griffiths, like literally war chattering as the world gets shattered and remade and so on. So, it's kind of crazy when you think that, yeah, people were bitching about some things they weren't seeing. And instead we're seeing this great fucking development.
Yeah, I'm not going to try to rationalize the ignorance of that kind of take. I do think for some people, probably it's like the fight against Ganeshka and Griffith is a foregone conclusion. Thus, there's no tension. Thus, can we get back to the quote-unquote real story? I'm just trying to rationalize why someone would have a problem with Volume 34, because I love it.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time people were just... I mean, when we got Fento on top of Ganishka,
yeah,
I don't think people were complaining. But yeah, it's just... I think it comes down to being impatient. People would want more faster. When they get to the island with Cascasque, more faster. Gassing versus Griffiths. And then when it's over, they're like, oh, I wanted more. Why is it? But yeah, you should have enjoyed what you got while we were on the way towards the ending. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I do remember I was extremely busy at this time of my life in 07 to 2010 because I was working a lot. This was before I had, you know, kids. So I was doing a lot of work, and I would look forward to each episode quite a bit, but I wasn't like poring over every page in the way that I do now with the rereads and the later episodic releases. And I remember enjoying 33 to 34, but it did reach a certain point where it's the kind of thing where you can get caught in the moment where if you just focus episode by episode, it's like, yeah, this is really good. But there's a certain point in 34 where you're like, holy shit, we are in the thick of it. Like, I think it's when Zod and Griffith are flying over. They basically start climbing up to Ganishka. And they're soaring over all the different spawn that everyone's fighting.
I think
that's an incredible, incredible sequence, incredible moment in the series.
Go ahead.
That I think I remember at the time, people were like, that's just too many two-page spreads. That's what I remember. The sentiment was like, oh, it's just too much two-page spreads. This is ridiculous. This is only like 6 pages. It's like, yeah, well, they're all incredibly realistic, incredibly detailed, amazing action sequences for two-page spreads. Sure, yeah.
What a complaint to have. I mean, then again, there was that guy who complained when Guts got the armor. So, you know.
Oh, well, what do you do?
Yeah, he was like, oh, are they going to all be getting armors now? Like Power Rangers? They're like, yeah, you know, are you sure? That's not a great take. Anyway, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, for me, as soon as when he plunges himself in the thing and then you see him rise up,
yep.
I mean, I was already like, what the fuck? That's insane. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The scale, giant fucking monster, like city size. I mean, it's beyond city size, actually. It's like mountain size. Crazy stuff, man. I mean, from that point on, I was already hooked before, but at the time, you're like, how is this going to end? And you know, of course, the great thing for me is this really, how to say, vindicated everything I thought about how it was going to go, that it wasn't just battle for a kingdom to get to blah, blah, blah. It was something more. And so it's exactly what I thought, you know. And, you know, Fantasia, fucking insane stuff. And I mean, Fantasia comes and then at the end, boom. The fucking brain, you know, the fucking thing.
Yeah, the brain appeared.
I mean, that's fucking crazy. It's like, it's when you know, like, fuck yes.
Yeah, Fantasia. I hope we get to see it one day.
I take comfort in what we got already. And I think we better not expect too much more than that.
All right, we're going to close it out there. We'll be back to finish. We probably will not come back to finish 35. I guess it's possible, but there's still several episodes. We might chunk that up into two podcasts, but happy to be back recording, and we'll be back as soon as we can, probably in a month.
All right. See you guys and girls and MDs.
The Skullcast is a production of Skullknight.net, a Berserk fan community. If you like what you heard, please visit patreon.com/sknet. Donations there do not go towards the podcast, but instead toward our resident translator, Puella, who ensures that our members have access to high-quality, text-based translations of Berserk. Puella has also been translating interviews with Berserk's creator, Kentaro Miura. Many of these interviews have never been translated into English, so it's very exciting to read those. That kind of work simply wouldn't have happened without support from our donors. If you'd like to chip in a buck or two, please know that it all helps. Once again, that's patreon.com/sknet. If you have a question or want to comment on the podcast, visit our forum, skullknight.net/forum. Near the top, you'll see a section devoted to the podcast. There's always an active thread in there, so go ahead, leave a post, and someone's sure to respond quickly. Thanks for listening!